Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Ryan, and I am an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for the organization Umpqua Watersheds. In this episode of Living Downstream, you'll hear from Mary Ann Shank as she reflects on her time in the Peace Corps in Somalia years ago. Before jumping into her interview, we'll take a moment to pause for a land acknowledgement, to remember that prior to European settlement, Indigenous groups tended the land and waters of this region, and they were often forcibly removed against their will. Some of the groups who once occupied the land within the Umpqua watershed and who are still found within its borders include Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Malala, and others. Acknowledging this part of the history is a way to resist the intentional erasing of Indigenous culture. In addition to our weekly land acknowledgement, we would love to incorporate Indigenous perspectives about what it means to live downstream, or live in such a way that those downstream are impacted less negatively. If you have knowledge to share on this topic, or would like to share current experiences of what it means to care for the environment now that ownership has become the way of the land, please reach out via email to ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Our next guest is Mary Ann Shank, local author and former Peace Corps volunteer. To start things off, could you speak to the culture that you experienced while in Somalia years ago?
Yes, this was a beautiful culture. This was the last of the peaceful culture in Somalia. The people were kind, they were generous. They were wonderful people. Right after I left, a civil war broke out, and that unfortunately changed the dynamic of the whole country. And since then, it's been in political turmoil. It's had ravages of drought thrust upon it. It's been a sad country. But I was there right at the end of what I would call the blessed period, and I enjoyed it so much. Somalia is basically a nomadic country. It began with nomads taking their camel trains and going from waterhole to waterhole to waterhole. Well, as you can imagine, there are different kinds of waterholes. Little waterholes developed with little villages around them, and the larger waterholes developed with larger developments around them. I was stationed in a town called Isha Baidoa, which meant wells of the people or springs of the people. And these were really artesian springs that just sprung out of the ground. They were the largest source of water in this whole region of several hundred miles. And so a rather large development developed around it. And these springs were so wonderful. They had a section even where kids could go swimming. They had a section for watering camels, and all kinds of camel trains came through. They had a section for getting water to the homes. And every morning you'd see a whole line of these men with their donkeys and their kerosene cans strapped to the donkeys, and they'd load up the kerosene cans and take them out to houses. And that's how we got water for our house, was through these kerosene cans. And at our house, this little guy with the donkey would come out, and he'd put his ladder against the side of the house and climb up this ladder with a kerosene can and dump it into a big barrel on the roof. And that was because our landlord, Omar Chicago, knew that these funny Americans liked indoor water. So he got us indoor plumbing with the big barrel on our roof. And he came out every morning, sometimes twice a day, with water on his camels. It was such a lovely culture. The Muslim culture is one that is based on family and sharing. And this is the culture that I came into. Our landlord, Omar Chicago, had built this little house just for Peace Corps volunteers. And it was like a little American house with two bedrooms and a bath and a living room and dining room and kitchen. He had a little round hovel of a house right next door. And he took care of us. My goodness, he really took care of us. He had a guard on our house 24 hours a day. He chaperoned us when we needed it. he vetted people who came to visit us to make sure they were okay for us to visit. And anything we wanted to know, he just helped us learn. He was such a wonderful, wonderful person to get to know. So I had a pretty good time there. I was teaching English. They wanted to make English the language of the government. So they brought in Peace Corps volunteers to help train the young students. And I taught in the middle school to help them learn English. And the very top level of the middle school would go on to the high school in Mogadishu, the capital city. And they were such anxious students. They knew that if they did well, they would proceed and go on and learn more and become leaders in their country. They just soaked up knowledge. I was really spoiled by them. Schools in the United States never felt the same after that. And while I was there too, I came to really appreciate the nomadic culture. At first, I'd see the camel trains go past our house, and I thought, oh my goodness, inshallah. No, bless God, take care of us. But it was much deeper than that. This was their culture. This was their way of life. When they left the springs of Baidoa, they knew where they were going. They were going to a waterhole, and they knew which waterhole. They had a little route established that they took every season. Along the way, they would meet other camel trains, and they would trade information about which waterholes were doing well and which were not, and they would head on accordingly. The respect that they had for each other and for the various camel trains that were out there was so deep. This whole region was like a great big family. They knew that if they took care of each other, they would all prosper. So when they went to a waterhole, whether it was the big one in Isha Baidoa or a smaller one out in the bush, they respected that water. They respected that land. Never would they go to a waterhole and waste water. They simply did not do it. Now, I don't think they had a word for conservation. It just This wasn't part of their lexicon, but they did it because it was part of their life. This is how they had been raised for generations and generations, and it was so much a part of their culture to simply respect the resources that were there. And also their camels. They took precious care of their camels. Camels, you may know, have four stomachs. And they have these four stomachs so that they can eat thorn bushes and digest the thorn bushes and squeeze the water out of them and turn it into milk, which was how the nomads survived, just on the milk from the camels. So they knew that these camels and caring for them really determined their livelihood in the bush. The camels died, they died. It was that simple. So they took tremendously good care of their camels. And I think sometimes it came down to a question even of who gets the most water, the people or the camels. And my guess is the camels. They knew that if people took the water, it was a short-term investment. But if camels took the water, it was a long-term investment, and perhaps they could make it to the next waterhole. I came to appreciate this so deeply in them. And I looked at our own culture when I had a real culture shock when I came back. And I looked at our own culture when we came back and I saw how we used water. I got really upset my first day or two back. I was driving along with my mom in Los Angeles and I saw this guy in his driveway and he was washing his car with water. I almost jumped out of the car and strangled the guy. This isn't something you can do when water is precious. The water in toilets upset me too. I mean, gee willikers, how much water do we need to flush a toilet? For 2 years, I didn't flush. We had a long drop and it worked just dandy. Once in a while, it stunk, but you know, you can live with that. And the water we waste here, just, it still astounds me. I try to be frugal, but I know that within culture, I'm expected to have a real potty for my guests to go to. And I do like watering my plants and keeping them alive. But I am constantly reminded of the culture where so much is so deeply respected that they don't even need a word for it. If I learned anything, that was probably the deepest thing that I learned. It was a lesson I will treasure my whole life. And I wish everyone had the chance to see this. When people go traveling, they tend to go for a week or two and kind of get a skim off the surface. But living there and knowing that, heck, you can live with a flushless toilet. This isn't the end of the world. I mean, you can live with water that you filter before you drink. It's good water. You can drink it. And to have that experience is absolutely invaluable. So that's my 30-second answer.
Yeah, no, I had thought of some questions that then you answered them during that. I've considered serving with the Peace Corps and currently am serving with AmeriCorps. Why did you choose to serve, or why did other people choose to serve that you interacted with?
I chose to serve because I wanted to travel. I was a California girl. I'd never been out of California. And here I was, 22 years old. I figured, son of a gun, it's time to do a little bit of traveling. So I signed up for the Peace Corps. And you know, in their brochures, the Peace Corps brochures, they show these exotic little islands. And there's a Peace Corps teacher reading stories to children under a palm tree. And it's all so idyllic. Well, it wasn't bad at all. But I'm so glad I did it. In my group, there were very few women. Most of the volunteers were males. And many of them went to avoid the draft. This was still during the era of the military draft. And during that time, some of the draft boards would use their Peace Corps service as service to the country and excuse them from the draft. Those were the lucky ones. Other ones got pulled out of the Peace Corps and sent into the draft anyhow. And some of them, when they came back from the Peace Corps, their names were thrown into the pool and they got into the draft. So a number of our guys were hoping, of course, to avoid the draft entirely by coming into the Peace Corps. But they were mostly good guys. It's not that they were draft evaders. They were peacekeepers. Let's put it that way. And I remember one time while we were sitting having a poker game late at night, and our house was the little welcoming house for the whole region. And two or three of the male Peace Corps volunteers were there, and one of them slammed his fist on the table. He said, I wish they'd draft me. He had been caught in crossfire. The unrest had just really begun. And he was thinking, you know, as long as he's going to be in crossfire, he might as well be in the army and have a gun himself. So it was right at that brink. Most of them were very peaceful people, and they wanted to see a greater sense of peace and serenity in the world. And a whole bunch of them worked in agriculture to help the Somalis learn about better, nutritious way of growing crops and helping them survive better. And that was all very commendable.
Yeah, I was thinking about just the way that war can ravage an ecosystem. And I was wondering, if you can, speak to just kind of some of what's happened in terms of the conflict's impact on natural ecosystems. And I was also kind of piggybacking on that, have you been back since, and how have things differed?
No, the country has been closed. About 6 months after I left, there was a massive evacuation of all foreigners. They were commanded out of the country within 24 hours by the lead government. And they were literally escorted airplanes and shot out of Somalia. We've not been able to go back since then. So no, I haven't been back personally. I see a lot of reports, and some of them I believe and some of them I don't. But for the most part, the areas that have been ravaged by war have truly been ravaged by war. Again, I don't think ecology is part of their mindset. When the wars begin, it's power That is their mindset. Al-Shabaab now has control of a good part of the country, and they want control. They want to be able to tell people what to do. It doesn't strike them that they're ruining the country by starting their village fires, by killing people. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Somalis have left the land. There are now more Somalis in the diaspora than there are in Somalia itself, which is very sad. But I don't think that the country that I knew is ever really going to come back again. What will come back, I hope, is some kind of Somalia that they create for themselves, some way of recapturing some of what they had before that was so beautiful and so precious. But you were in AmeriCorps. I wanted to travel. What did you want?
Yeah, kind of a number of things. I had been a teacher for 5 years, and I really love certain aspects of teaching, and I value educators so highly, but felt very undervalued as an educator, which is just so unfortunate. You know, there's so much was asked of me and the other teachers. And I mean, I certainly wasn't there for the pay, but it was like, I don't know, we kept being asked or told to do more and more all the time and not really getting anything in addition. And so it was just, you know, in the evening I was reading, and just that was a huge time commitment outside of work that you weren't getting paid for. But yeah, so I taught for a number of years, and I realized that that wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, classroom teaching. And I have always loved and wanted to protect the environment. And so I have tons of interests, but wasn't sure exactly what my in would be. Like, would it be environmental education? Would I, you know, work at a nonprofit? Did I want to still work in a school or do after school programs? Like, I had a number of options and ideas, but I wasn't sure what to do. And so I had heard of people doing AmeriCorps and known other people who had done AmeriCorps. And it seemed like a really good way to learn new skills and narrow my scope. That's kind of how I always phrase it, is I was trying to narrow the scope. And so last year I served with Eco AmeriCorps in Vermont, and that helped narrow the scope of certain things I did and didn't want to do. And then now serving in Oregon with an environmental organization as an environmental education outreach leader, I know exactly what I want to do. So it's been very helpful for me to figure out what path I want to take. And then there's also an additional, you know, education award that you get at the end, which is super helpful because I still have tons of debt from, you know, getting my master's in teaching. And I think people don't realize just how much debt people who don't have a lot of money to start with have. And that's such a limiting factor. It's like debilitating to try to get out from under it. So that's just one huge benefit is that education award. And so that is part of why I served as well, because, you know, I want to be able to really help the world, help, you know, youths learn, help connect people to the environment, protect the environment, adopt animals, you know, different types of things to help others. And because I was spending so much money on loans, I was very limited in what I could do to help others. So
honorable.
I'm excited. Yep. And hopeful.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're also an author, right? Can you share a little about your book or the different books you've written?
Sure. I've written most of my career, but mostly in business. I was in the venture capital field for many years, and I used my library degree to do research and writing for business plans and business development. Well, when I semi-retired, I decided it was time to really start thinking about Somalia again. It had been haunting me for years. I knew there were things there that I needed to write, but I didn't know how to. And it really took concentration. It took me, 40 years of being away from it to let it settle in. And then another 2 years of actually writing and revising to get it to the point where I could say, okay, this was my experience. I finally put it into print about a year ago, and it's called The Mystical Land of Myrrh. Frankincense and myrrh are grown in Somalia, northern Somalia. And the frankincense and myrrh in the biblical story of Jesus probably came from Somalia. They were part of the Silk Road trade, and ships came through northern Somalia, picked up the frankincense and myrrh, and took it over to the Arab countries. So they were very much a part of that trade, and it's very likely that the frankincense and myrrh came from there. So when I came to title my book, that just seemed so logical. It is a country of magic and mystery, things that people don't even know, things that I didn't learn about until I came back over here. They have cave paintings that are ancient as any cave paintings in the world, and they're beautiful. This is an old, old culture. So I set this down into this book, The Mystical Land of Myrrh. And I'm very proud of it. It is available on Amazon. When that finished, I started working on some children's books, which I'm working on now, and then I'll be working on another adult book as well. So I've been busy, I've been writing, I've been growing my garden. I've been pretty happy. One other thing I wanted to talk about, what I learned from Somalis, and this I didn't even realize until fairly recently. When I was in Somalia, they sent us over, we each had a trunk, and most of the trunk had books and paper and stuff we needed in it. Well, I put in two sets of clothes, a blue outfit and a brown outfit, and an extra pair of shoes and some undies and a nightie and stuff. And that was it. That's what I lived on for 2 years. Perfectly happy. Fit right in with the people. No ostentatious anything. Just, you know, either my blue outfit or my brown outfit. I did have one thing made over there that was a little fancier for the formal things we had to go to. And when I left Somalia, they gave us our stipend at the end of our service. And I used it to travel through Europe. And I spent 3 months traveling, but I didn't have a suitcase. What I had was this shopping bag, like a sisal shopping bag. And again, I put in a change of clothes, a little map, Europe on $5 a day. And I traveled for 2 months with that little sisal bag. And I did just fine. Oh, I stuck in the fancy dress I had. I had that for when I went to the ballet or the opera. But basically, the two changes of clothes and one fancy outfit, and life was wonderful. I got back to the States, and I was looking around here not too long ago, and my God, I've got two full closets stuffed. There is no reason in the world I need two full closets stuffed. If Somalia taught me nothing else, it taught me about frugality, about how getting along with less really is getting along with more. Over there, I didn't have to stop and think, oh, what am I going to wear today? I wore the brown yesterday, I'll wear the blue today. A simple decision. Here, life seems to get more complicated with stuff. If we had a way in this country of simply getting rid of the stuff we've got, we could change the world. How many of us can get along, really get along pretty nicely with half of the stuff that we've got? That's clothes, that's dishes, that's everything. Just half the car even. Most of us can get along very nicely with a smaller car than what we've got. Half the house. How many of us really need a whole house? Families, okay, we'll give families their extra bedrooms. But for the most part, we don't need big houses. We could all get along very nicely with tiny houses and sharing a bunch of stuff. It could absolutely revolutionize our whole country if we could just get our minds around that concept of sharing rather than owning, that we have to own everything, even books. My walls are filled with books. I can only read one or two at a time. This is silly for me to have several hundred books here. And a lot of people do this. So if I had a wish on how to make our country and our universe more conservationally aware, I think I would look to frugality, to the concept of sharing with each other rather than owning, the concept of living small while living so much broader, because then everything would belong to us, not just the stuff that we owned. I think it would be a wonderful way to live if we ever had a way of developing that. So that was something that Somalia really taught me. The trunk that I went with and the basket that I left with were just all I needed in life.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for simplicity. I too have lots and lots of books. I feel like part of me justifies it in like, well, I'm lending them, so they're not just mine. Like once I read them, I usually pass them along. But it's so true. Like we have so many more clothes and, like you said, dishes and just so many things that we don't need. Like, are we really using them all the time? Like, why do we own them? And my boyfriend and I have been going through the last couple of years and just like kind of paring down, you know, and it actually feels so good. It's like a weight has been lifted to give those things away we're not using, or even if we might have used sometimes, but someone else could benefit from more. Like, why are we holding on to the thing we might wear once a year? You know, like I enjoyed it, you know, but somebody else might love it and wear it like every other week or something, you know? So
And if we had a big community closet that we could borrow things from, my goodness, we could have fancy outfits anytime we wanted.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
And you know, in Ashland, there is actually an organization that lends out party plates and dishes. So you don't have to own any of that stuff for a party. You can just go borrow it from them. My next door neighbor helps volunteer to that, is how I found out about it. And when you return it, of course, you return it reasonably clean, but they put everything through cleaning. So when you get the dishes, they're all nice and clean, and you borrow them for a day or a few days, whatever you need, and then you return them and somebody else uses them. That's such a great idea. I wish we had more of that in different categories of stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've heard of that type of thing with furniture or something, because especially thinking about people coming like right out of college or moving or maybe in an internship, you know, like rather than buying all your own and then transporting. I mean, I definitely saw that with coming across country from back east. Just like, okay, what am I going to bring? What am I going to leave behind? What am I going to either sell or just donate? And I mean, yeah, just so much stuff. We just get so bogged down. And I mean, we have to just, like you were mentioning about just taking, you know, the Cecil bag with you, and like, it's easier to travel when you don't have as much holding you down or weighing you down or holding you back. And, you know, like planning for my return trip home, it's like, okay, what am I going to leave? I've accumulated more stuff. So when am I going to leave? What am I going to donate? What am I going to get rid of in some way? And what am I going to mail back to myself? Just, yeah, thinking about like accounting for all this stuff is just, yeah, if we could pare down, get rid of things, it would help us. We don't realize it sometimes, but it would help us. Mm-hmm. And it would obviously help other people as well.
Yes.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Would you like to volunteer with Umpqua Watersheds? We'll be holding a virtual volunteer training via Zoom Saturday, June 19th from 9 to 11 a.m. Attendees will learn about a variety of new ways to get involved with our organization, roles suitable for multiple ages and ability levels. If you'd like to learn more or sign up to attend, email our AmeriCorps member at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Mark your calendars for our volunteer training June 19th.
So you spoke about this a little bit, just kind of going back to something that you mentioned earlier. How does, for people who haven't been to Africa at all and haven't been to Somalia, at least based on your recollection, how do the ecosystems and then like the natural environment there differ, and how are they similar to the Pacific Northwest?
Oh, radically different. Somalia is right on the horn of Africa. You probably know that the Sahara Desert has, over the millennia, has been reaching further and further south. So Somalia itself has been getting warmer and warmer and warmer over the millennia. When I was there, I would call it bush country. In fact, the first trip I made was going from Mogadishu inland to my station at Isha Baidoa. And we went for something like 7 hours through bush country. We were in a Land Rover bumping over this bumpy road. And all we could see were bushes. That's all there was. Bushes after bushes after bushes, mile after mile of bushes. And of course, they've adapted to it because their camels eat the thorn bushes. But that's what the country is thorn bushes with sporadic water holes. They don't even have dams. Now, along the edges of the country, both along the western edge and the northern edge, there are some mountain ranges that do get a different type of culture in them. And they have more wildlife in them, different kind of wildlife and more flowers and that sorts of stuff. But those are in the mountain ranges. In the flatlands in between, it's bush country. Anyone who hadn't lived there would probably call it desert. But it's not an arid desert. It's a bush environment, which is very different from a desert. Bush country was just feet away from where I lived. In Ishabaidoh itself, they had planted things like bougainvillea and other plants to brighten up the environment. But just a few steps away was the edge of the bush country. And I used to wander out into that from time to time. And there was activity in this bush land. There were these little insects that flew from bush to bush to bush, just like they do here from flower to flower to flower. And of course, they had adapted there. They had a praying mantis that I recognized, but most of the little creatures I didn't. There were, you know, little butterflies and little waspy creatures and little bees, but not lots of anything because there weren't a lot of vegetation to support them. I'm sure that there were a lot of things that I did not see. I didn't see many snakes, and I know they're somewhere. I did not see a lion, although I saw lion footprints. Yeah, they came down from the mountains occasionally when they were hungry. There were little dig-digs that I did see. These are the little deer creature that are about 2 feet tall, and they jump like they're on trampolines. Cute little critters, just adorable little dig-digs. There were a few wildlife like that and a few birds. Once in a while, I'd hear a bird cooing in one of the trees or bushes. It was such a treat to hear it. It was a very different environment than what we have here. I didn't have a lot of time to explore the environment. I was teaching 6 days a week and usually 5 to 7 classes a day. It was a heavy, heavy workload. So on our one day off, which is Friday, I usually slept. Either that or went into Mogadishu. So I didn't explore the desert as much as I wish I had, because I know that there was just so much there that I could have learned if I had just taken the time to go in. And if I were to go back, if I were to do it again, I'd grab one of these nomads going with his camels and walk with them for at least a couple days and then walk home, just to get a feeling for what they do in the bush and what they see and understand. So I'm sure that there is just so much that this bush country tells them about the weather and the water and the animals in the area. Just so much information they would grab from the desert because they know it so well, just so well. And I wish I had done that. If anyone does go to an area like that, take the time to get to know the native people and see through their eyes what they're seeing. See a whole different world than what I saw.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear too how people really like learn to live in a place, like you mentioned about like the frugality with water and not wasting resources. And sometimes I feel like whether here or just anywhere I've lived, like when people feel like, oh, there's plenty, then they waste it, right? Like they don't think of it, even though maybe not too far away, it's a very limited resource. Well, we have a lot here, so we can do whatever we want. And we really need to not think of it that way. And I was thinking too, in Oregon, I've heard people say like the Umpqua River, like, you know, it has its own way. It meanders around. And like, so the roads got built around it rather than diverting it. You know, it was kind of allowed to traverse the way that it has traveled. Which is interesting because I know a lot of places, yeah, the waters are diverted to make way for man's progress or something. But
yes, yeah, but you're right. In Somalia, too, there are two rivers in southern Somalia. Where I lived was right in between the two rivers where the spring came up. But along the rivers, they have built little settlements along the rivers. Ironically, nothing too big. And I was wondering about that, even as I was thinking about our talk today, you know, why didn't they build Baidoa by the river? And they didn't, because the river had schistosomiasis in it. And they knew that it was limited. They didn't even eat the fish out of the river. They did use the river to water crops. So along the river, if you took a bird's eye view of it, a camera, it would show a lot of crop areas right along the rivers, but not very many settlements, not very many towns. And they had a rather basic watering system. They'd bring the water up in buckets and up and into these canals that would then lead it into the crop areas. But yes, they had just tremendous respect for those rivers. And those were, you know, pretty big rivers. If they had learned how to work with the water, life would have been much easier for them. But the other thing that did it was the tremendous sense of community that they had. Somalia had five major family groups within the country, which were then broken into smaller family groups. And these family groups truly did watch out for each other. You know, just like the nomads wouldn't dry up a water hole because they knew somebody else was coming in to use it. So too at the larger water holes, even in the villages. They simply did not waste it because they knew that others from the family would want to come through and use it as well. And there was a respect there for other people's needs as well as for your own. It was a beautiful environment to live in because of that respect that they had for each other and caring for each other.
I'm curious, how did the conflict, like I studied some conflicts in Africa in general, but how did the conflicts in Somalia get started?
Oh dear, you're going to send me off on my political binge, aren't you? It was at the end of World War II. The Allies decided they ruled the world and they were going to set the boundary lines wherever they wanted. They went into Africa and Somalia was the family groups that kind of overlapped each other, but they each pretty much knew their territory. And Somalia itself pretty much knew where it was, although some of the people kind of, you know, oozed over into Ethiopia or Kenya. And it was all pretty much okay. Well, in come the Allies and they draw the lines. Somalis, you're on that side. Ethiopians, you're on that side. They set up a structure within Somalia of three smaller countries, Djibouti, which still exists up in northern Somalia, North Somalia, which was British controlled, and Southern Somalia, which was Italian controlled. In 1960, they determined that North and South Somalia should become independent, and they decided to join together. Well, during the time they were under foreign control, we had imposed on them the necessity to set up a representative form of government with a president at the head. This is what we knew. So we said, okay, guys, this is what you're going to do. The political environment that they had had before was very tribal oriented, family oriented. And suddenly here was this president up above everybody. This president had tremendous powers, far more than anybody in their tribal environment ever had. And that was in 1960, they became independent and set the president up. I was there at the end of the 60s, 67 to 69. By then they had figured out that whatever tribe could put the president up there on top had loads of control. The foreign aid came into them and they could dole it out to their own special friends. They could get the people they wanted to do what they wanted to do. They could build the schools and the hospitals and everything in their own region. I mean, this guy had a lot of control and he could tax. He had lots of money. So the conflicts were in who was going to control the country. Before we got involved, they managed this pretty well on their own. In their own little groups. And they settled their differences through selecting a settlement person to settle it. And it got settled. You know, hey, you killed somebody, here's 50 camels that the killer is going to have to pay you. And that's how they settled it. Now with this structure that they had imposed on Benton, it was very, very different. The only way they knew to control was to force the votes. And so that's what they began to do. They fought tremendously to get votes. I felt that a great deal just before I left, that tension, the arguing, the bickering, the fighting. There were physical fights even then on who should be the rulers of the country, the ruler of the country. And just after I left, the whole thing exploded. The gentleman who had been the prior president was reelected. He did come in again. But just a couple of months later, he was assassinated. And that threw the whole country into pandemonium. And since then, it's been a battleground. Northern Somalia has broken off, and they have been more peaceful than the others. And they're trying to reestablish more tribal control than was under the strong central government, which is great. This is the kind of political environment that they're used to, is having the local government stronger. And I'm hoping that they do eventually get recognized as a separate country, because they are succeeding in that. But the southern part has been weaker, and part of it is even ruled by Al-Shabaab now. Al-Shabaab rules the town that I was in, which just breaks my heart. But they're the ones in control in that area now. So it's going to take them longer to adjust to a different type of political environment. So it's been in turmoil. It just takes a while. You know, once we go in and we disrupt everything so terribly, it just takes a while for them to go back and bring it back to themselves. And they're in the process. They're doing it. We just need to leave them alone so they can do it.
In that last part of what you were saying, I was just thinking about how with natural ecosystems, it sometimes we go in and we disrupt the process, and we need to just leave it alone. Like, I was like, if you just changed a couple of the words, it would be just the same, you know, like if we go in and we alter everything and clear cut all of the forest, like, it's like we need to respect what we have and what isn't even ours to have in ownership sense, but respect what's around us and respect the cultures.
Absolutely. We shouldn't try to control. We've got to give that up. As a human people, we have to stop controlling.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is now offering opportunities for youths to have their voices heard, literally, on our radio program, Living Downstream. Kids ages 8 to 18 are invited to submit a 1 to 3 minute audio recording describing what they love about the place in which they live. These could be poems, essays, stories, or songs. We welcome their creativity. Submissions should be sent to our environmental education and outreach leader at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org with youth entry, sense of place, in the subject line. This is a great opportunity for families and classes alike.
Yeah, I think that there's like two of the biggest causes of conflict. You know, one is like this desire to have control, dominance, wanting to, you know, be in power. And then a lot of conflicts I know in Africa and elsewhere, and likely more in the future, are coming from natural, quote unquote, natural resource scarcity. So as, you know, certain areas are getting drier and there's less water, or as there are fewer trees or fewer, you know, minerals from mining and different things, like, I mean, the population is continuing to go up. And so if we think about it, right, like, okay, there's a lot of people and everybody needs water to drink. Everybody needs a safe place to live. So we need to really be mindful of our resource consumption and how we're using things. And like you said, if we have all this extra stuff, do we need all that extra stuff? Probably not.
Yeah, and the natural resources was one of the big points of contention in Somalia. All around Somalia, oil was being discovered, but not in Somalia. When I was there, it hadn't been discovered yet. And they were feeling somehow rejected by the world because everybody else was getting wealthy and they were not. They were back in their pre-oil days. Well, then oil was discovered in southern Somalia. And of course, that caused a tremendous amount of fighting over who gets the money from the oil. And then in central Somalia, I believe, there is a very rare mineral that's used in computer development. I don't even know what that mineral is. There are two different minerals, but it's very rare and it's very precious. And that is now being mined, of course. And the rich countries, including China and Russia and the United States, are vying to get those fields for those minerals to develop computers. And that's what's giving Somalia its money now. And right now, the money that's going into Somalia is going into southern Somalia, unfortunately. And the northern area that is more peaceful isn't getting it because it's not recognized by the international world. But yeah, resources have had a big influence on Somalia.
Yeah, it makes me think of, I don't know if you've seen the movie Avatar. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
No, okay. So in the movie Avatar, there's this other planet that's been discovered that has living beings that are similar to humans and that kind of thing. But there's this rare mineral. I think they call it unobtainium or something like that. or something that's hard to get to basically. But they really want to use it. It's really valuable back home. And so they're willing to go to any length to get this mineral. And they find that, like, not a huge spoiler, hopefully if people haven't seen it, but like they find that one place that it is located is under, you know, a place that's really sacred and special to this culture. And so mm-hmm. some people are like, it doesn't matter. We want this thing. We're going to go in and get it no matter what it takes, like the ends, you know, justify the means kind of thing. But then on the flip side, the notion would be perhaps we should leave it. Even if it's something we really want, if it's going to be so destructive, so harmful, so violent to obtain this just for our own gain, it's probably not worth it. But yeah, it's worth watching. I really like it. I appreciate it a lot. But there's also like, it's intense because like they come through and like this place called Home Tree. And it's like this really neat, like interwoven structure and they just destroy it. Like, I mean, it's just like they kill all sorts of people because it's like, they don't matter to them. You know, the violence is a lot, but yeah. But anyway, it reminded me what you were talking about, reminded me of that. Just like the notion of like, okay, like just because like a group that's in power wants something, like they feel like they can do whatever, they're entitled. They feel like they can do whatever to have it. And that really doesn't work, right? We end up with conflict. We end up with death. We end up with war. And then not only do the people suffer, but the planet suffers because then when you're in that conflict situation and you're just struggling to survive and, you know, needing to build a fire or needing to cook food or whatever, then it's like, okay, well, this is available. So I need to take it. Even if people might not have acted that way where they were before. And then, like you have refugee camps, resettlement camps all over the world and just,
That is Somalia. It truly is. They could have lifted the script from Somalia, which is sad.
Yeah. Well, thinking about how to not end on a sad note as much as possible. We've kind of spoken about this a little bit, but what's the relationship between peace and environmental protection?
Tremendous. They go hand in hand. When there was peace in Somalia, caring for each other and caring for the environment was a natural part of their lives. It's just how they lived, what they did. See, I don't think they even had a word for conservation. It was so much a part of them that they couldn't separate it out. And when the wars came, you survive. All you do is survive. There was so much killing, so much desperation. I've read stories about even where young boys in their teens would come up to a house and determine whether or not they were in the good clan or the bad clan and decide on the spot whether or not to kill somebody and did. It's so much a matter of survival. The atrocities in war supersede anything that anyone can think of. It's just so consuming. All you want to do is to protect your family and yourself as best you can, whether it means hiding in place or getting out of there and going somewhere else. Your whole focus becomes protection. Again, it's not that they're trying to hurt the environment, but it does get hurt. They over-reap the crops. They hurt the land. They foul the water so that the opposing tribe can't drink it. They kill the camels and livestock that kept people alive and worked with the bush country. They turn the country into a nightmarish hell of its own. I wasn't there then, but I've read reports of people who were or who have went through it after that, and it's a different country. It simply was a different country in war. Parts of it still are. It's so sad. They had so much to live with, so much to give. They were only allowed to do it if we hadn't gone in and changed them, frankly.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times Western cultures don't think about the role we play, right? So, we establish something as good and righteous and just and the way that it should be done everywhere, and forget that, you know, yeah, some of these cultures have existed for really long times and maybe have found things that worked and enabled them to coexist and live in harmony with the land and water. And so when we cause that upheaval and try to assert that our way is the best way, then yeah, it just has such detrimental impacts downstream, which like this show is called Living Downstream. But I mean, this is just another example of that, right? Like, you know, something we do today or in a certain location, like trickles down. It has impacts elsewhere and down the line time-wise.
Well, yes, for generations.
Yeah. And just so many different places with war. Like if we release a nuclear bomb, like, okay, then you have radiation.
Or drop harsh chemicals like Agent Orange or something.
And there's like children born with deformities and things. I mean, you know, there's toxins still in the soil from when we had, you know, certain factories that produce certain types of pollution. There's increasing amounts of evidence that some of the chemicals in pesticides and herbicides stay in the soil for like 7, 10, however many years, and it's killing so many types of insects. And it's just, okay, we need to take a step back. We need to pause and think about what we're doing before we do it. And I would assert that the ends don't justify the means. You know, if our goal is to have profit above all else, like, why? That's not the best thing. And we need to not be so power oriented and money oriented. If we're going to survive as a species, as a planet, interconnected with everyone else.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, in Baidoa itself, there was a USAID station, USAID station, which is a State Department run service. They had the station there and they had a tractor there and they had pesticides, and they had their demo farm that they developed with a tractor. Smallies don't have tractors. They have oxen if they're lucky, and pesticides. And they were teaching Somalis how to use tractors and pesticides to increase their crops. And it just sickened me that they did that. There were so many other things they could have taught them rather than how to use tractors and pesticides. And when everyone was pulled out with that 24-hour notice, USAID was also pulled out. They ran and left those barrels of pesticides just sitting there. And it had to infest not only that area, but get into the underground water in the aquifer and affect a wide area with all of those pesticide leaks. It was really cruel, very cruel.
You've already mentioned what you would do differently if you went back. Have you talked with any other Peace Corps or AmeriCorps members about their experiences, maybe in other countries? And like what have they said about their experiences?
Yes. In fact, we have a Peace Corps group here in Southern Oregon. We're all from different countries. I'm the only one from Somalia. And we talk about the things that we went through. And it's surprising how many of us had very similar experiences in very different countries. And I also belong to a group of Somali returned Peace Corps volunteers. And even though we were in different areas of the country and doing different things, a lot of us also had very similar experiences. It was not sitting under a palm tree reading stories to children. It's just not for any of us.
It's good to know that going in, though, for people who are thinking like, oh, I want to do this thing. And it is helpful. Like, there's a lot of potential. I mean, I've looked into doing the Peace Corps and may at some point, I've really enjoyed my experience with AmeriCorps and feel like I've learned so much. Like you keep mentioning too, just like you learn so much being outside of your comfort zone, outside of, you know, the culture and country that you grew up in. And just there's so much we can gain, like not to do it just for yourself, but like there is so much we can gain by being open to and learning from others. And I just, yeah, like I have encouraged like former students of mine to join AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps. I've talked with them and, you know, shared some of my experiences, but it's great to hear that there's a group. 'Cause I know that just reading and hearing from other people who have experienced service programs like Peace Corps and AmeriCorps, more significantly probably in the Peace Corps, just, yeah, like you really need that time to process and you need time to, you know, communicate with others about what you learned and figure out, okay, like, how am I going to use this going forward now that I am back in the US or back in whatever country you hailed from? And you're seeing all these things around and like, there's all this stuff and there's, you know, different infrastructure and yeah, how am I going to make my way in the world now that I know what else is out there, or at least a small snippet of what else is out there? Are there any concluding, as we wrap up, are there any concluding thoughts you'd like to share?
Oh, that pretty well, you know, nailed it. Go in for the palm trees and the stories. That'll get you in it. Come out with something so much deeper and more rewarding than you could ever have imagined. And let it settle for a while. And then you'll begin to understand what you really have learned. It's the toughest job you'll ever love. I've heard that so often. And before I went in, I thought, oh, sure, yeah. But it is. It's the toughest job you'll ever love. And I really encourage people to partake. And now Peace Corps is focusing more on older people and people with specialized training. So if you have any type of training in ecology, in the environment, in the health services, in teaching, in business even, they'd be very interested in having you join them for a couple of years. And they have shorter terms than 2 years now also. You don't have to go for the whole 2 years. Whatever fits your schedule, they'll find something to make you useful.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your service and also for your experiences you've shared on the show today.
Well, thank you too. I really enjoyed it, Ryan.